I'd like now to welcome Marilyn Fidua. She is the author of the book Maria of Agreda, Mystical Lady in Blue, published by University of New Mexico Press. And she will be at Garcia Street Books today from 5 to 6 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. And I must compliment you on your Spanish accent, probably better than mine.
Thank you. So who was Maria of Agreda and how did you find out about her?
Two of my favorite questions. She was an inspiring 17th century figure. She was an abbess, an author, a mystic, an advisor to the King of Spain. And I found out about her works in the most unlikely of ways. I was in my mother-in-law's library after she passed away and was very intrigued in Michigan. And now I start saying in Michigan in the middle of nowhere, you know, compared to her story, which is so rooted in Spain and New Mexico and Texas. But nevertheless, I was in Michigan. I found her books in my mother-in-law's library and became intrigued about what my mother-in-law had read. Started paging through it. And Mary Charlotte, this is 2,700 pages.
Right.
Yes. So, but I needed some relaxation in the evenings. I was vice president of Olivet College in Michigan, and we were renovating our 1950s home at the time. And I thought, oh, what better way at night to unwind, to listen, to read the calm, contemplative story of a 17th century abbess who was cloistered away in Agreda, Spain. And little did I know how exciting her life would be. I became intrigued.
Right. So she was a nun, and I guess you would call her a mystic. Now, mystics don't exactly hold a revered place in mainstream society today, and in fact, they're not even deemed to be real. What was she, and what is the role of the mystic, which I think is usually a woman, in 17th century Europe?
Oh, and there were many mystics at the time. In Spain in particular, I'll speak about, one of my friends used to say, oh, mystics grew around that area just like they were in the water, you know, like it was in the water. And a mystic is really, it's not a very mystifying term when you kind of break it down and think about it. A mystic is someone who, through my interpretation, through deep contemplative prayer, reaches a deep inner state of spirituality. And often with that state of spirituality come what we might call unusual experiences. They might start out with a certain interior kind of knowing spiritual truths, and then it might also branch out into visions, and in her case, some highly unusual experiences of bilocating or being in two places in the same time, which is how she wound up in New Mexico and Texas.
Right. Now, bilocation is a term that I'd never even heard until I was reading your work. What does that mean, and what did it mean in her case?
Okay, good question. Bilocation is, in short, it's being, the truest sense of the word would be being in two places at one and the same time. For example, she would be in her convent in Spain and also be in Texas, say in the Palo Duro Canyon area with the Humano Native Americans, physically in both places. That would be a technical interpretation of the word. And in her case, however, she always said she never really believed it was a physical bilocation. She felt it was more spiritual. And today we might interpret that as more of a psychic experience, like some people have ESP, or they have highly developed sense of intuition. And so mystical experiences are really, they're just on the continuum. I would say a mystical experience could start out sitting in your living room and having a deep, convicting thought about something that matters a lot to you, and then you might have an intuition about what to do about it. Just kind of fast forward that through a spiritual development, hard for we mere mortals sometimes to think of, but really it's on a continuum. It's just more unusual. But the Catholic saint has mystics, the Catholic Church has mystics. St. Padre Pio was known to bilocate, and also comes to mind St. Anthony of Padua. So it's unusual, but there are a lot of what I would call the wisdom traditions of many religions where there are some unusual experiences there by sainted, holy people. She was one of them.
Let's go back to the early life of Maria of Agreda. She was born in Spain in 1602, and she was born with such spiritual gifts that she was ordained by the age of four. What did that look like?
Okay, not technically ordained in the sense that you might think of a priest being ordained into a religious order, but her parents were very spiritual, and they were, as a matter of fact, members of the Third Order of St. Francis, and they had their children in quiet prayer from an early age, and she was a very wise child. And the bishop of the nearby town met her when she was four and decided she was so spiritually adept at that time that he confirmed her, which is the sacrament of confirmation in the Roman Catholic Church.
Right.
And it's normally a sacrament that's not conferred until, like, a child at, say, seven reaches the quote-unquote age of reason. But she was a highly developed little girl, very sensitive, very spiritual, and he talked with her at length and, of course, knew the family, and at that point advised them to set up a separate room in her house as an oratory. That would be like a place she could go and pray, which they did, and her mother tutored her. And so from a very early age, she was tutored in the ways of religion.
And amazingly enough, she had a dark night of the soul at the age of six, and then came back after an illness with a great joyous light inside of her. And then she became a cloistered nun. What did she do then? What was her life like?
It's so fascinating. And when I was in Spain, I could actually see the environment in which she lived and practiced her faith. And the convent is constructed to shelter the nuns in a huge, it's a huge structure with one wing, of course, would be their cells, a big church, a choir, and meeting rooms that we, the public, like, get to go in, small meeting rooms with a hole cut in the wall with a grill there so that, you know, actually nothing can penetrate physically between a visitor, say, and the nuns. And they lived cloistered lives. They had veils over their faces when they met with people. And they had a very rigorous schedule of prayer starting early in the morning and with a few breaks, like going on through early evening, rest a little bit, get up and pray and start all over again. And it was a very devotional, I would call it a very sweet environment. I was so taken with the nuns that I met in her convent. It's still an operational convent today. And they carry on in her tradition. And I asked them one day, I said, well, where is your most important work today, spiritually? And they said, it is in that area of the quote-unquote quiet prayer that Sor Maria practiced and that they practice today. And it is a Franciscan tradition, but it certainly is something that was just practiced with great devotion and great meaning in that convent, and probably throughout the religious order. But anybody today who practices meditation of some sort might experience a very similar result to that contemplative prayer that they engaged in.
We're talking to Marilyn Fidua. She's the author of the book Maria of Agreda, Mystical Lady in Blue. So talk about Catholicism in Spain at that time. There were very pious people like these cloistered nuns, but also strong anti-Semitism and, of course, the Spanish Inquisition. What was going on?
Oh, my goodness. You hit the nail on the head. The Inquisition was perhaps not what would be called in full force because maybe executions had lessened in number to a certain extent, but Sor Maria was actually tracked by the Inquisition for decades. And people were fearful that if they professed to believe something or have unusual experiences that might not be considered what the church would endorse, that they could lose anything from their Catholic status to their lives. And, of course, the discrimination against the Jews had been going on since 1492, the Edict of Torquemada, and at that point, Jews were actually expelled from Spain, or they were given the opportunity to convert to Catholicism. And in Sor Maria's case, it was thought that her early ancestors around that time of Columbus did convert to Catholicism and change their name to Coronel, which is her birth name. Although there's not exact documentation in her family tree. I have a gap of about 3 or 4 generations there. But like St. Teresa of Avila, it is thought that Maria of Agreda was had Jewish ancestry, and then her family converted. So there was the Inquisition, the state against Jewish conversos even, and what was your third item?
The life of the nuns, which seems really very pious in comparison mm-hmm. to these other kind of political forces.
Yeah, and at the same time, there was an extreme respect for deeply religious people. Some people used to say there were miracles in the air, and the Spaniards were going around looking for the next saint in this life. And so when the news of Sor Maria's unusual mystical experiences started leaking out of the convent, she became quite famed in a way that was not necessarily very comfortable for her. As a matter of fact, she, like St. Teresa, in deep after and during deep prayer, sometimes was seen to actually levitate, that is, lift up off the ground for a little space. And there was a little window in a door to her cell, and the other nuns would actually watch her sometimes, unbeknownst to her, and to her utter dismay, to feel that she was in a private moment in prayer and that she was being watched. But there were people who did watch her, and it's written up in her first biography. So those kind of news items, like spread, you know, despite the lack of technology then, news still traveled fairly fast, and there was a deep reverence for spiritual matters and holy people and, you know, anyone who could help one feel closer to God and their religion. And there was a lot of development going on at the time, too, in terms of some of the doctrines of the Catholic Church. And one of them was the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. And it was so controversial that there were thousands and thousands of tracts, little pamphlets that were being distributed throughout the country saying, yes, we think it's important and it's a good doctrine, and no, we don't. You know, we think that it's counter to the redemption and so forth. And so that was part of the political and what you call religious atmosphere she lived in, too, because she was very pro the Immaculate Conception of Mary, which is part of her religious order in Spain at that time. She's a conceptionist Franciscan nun, and she believed that. And in a nutshell, like just to kind of boil that down a little bit, the Immaculate Conception of Mary means when Mary was conceived by her parents, that she was conceived without the original sin and
right.
through the grace of God. And so the people who were for that said, well, yes, because she's the mother of Jesus, you know, that she should be a pure vessel. We think it's an important doctrine. It must be true. People against it said, oh, nobody can be that. You know, why would we need somebody who was without sin? What do we need the redemption for? And they were against it.
Just moving on a little bit to Maria de Agreda's life, she wrote what I guess was called a biography of the Virgin Mary. What does that mean? I mean, you know, many centuries after the life of Jesus and Mary.
Yes, and that was the book that I found in my mother-in-law's study. I say book, but it's really, my set is 4 books, equaling 2,700 pages. So Sor Maria's story of the life of Mary is really, I think, most correctly described today by some theologians as a theological poem, in a sense. Some people have called it a novel. You know, it's based on what she considered her visions of Mary. And it's also based on a Gnostic gospel, that is one that's not in the four gospels in the Bible, but it's based on the proto-evangelium of James, which goes into much greater detail on the life of Mary and was written centuries and centuries before Sor Maria. So she had her levels of deep prayer and her contemplative visions when they focused on Mary, and she also contemplated the proto-evangelium. She was devoted to Mary very much as a beautiful, iconic spiritual figure in the mother of Jesus, and she was inspired to write her story. So in Baroque days, Mary Charlotte, this is like very, a lot of hyperbole in there, and
right.
a lot of repetition, and a lot of, you know, what might be called exaggeration, and a lot of definitions that come up in her writing are, you know, fairly traditional Catholic things that go back to St. Augustine. You know, she had her own theology straight for the time, and so she wrote a very devotional story, an interpretation of the life of Mary.
Now, let's go back to this so-called bilocation. Native American Indians in the Southwest had visions of a lady in blue and said that she wandered among them preaching. Meanwhile, she herself had some kind of mystical experience that was connected to that. Tell us what that story was.
Mm-hmm. She would go into these deep states of prayer, and she had always had a longing to be a missionary. When she was a little girl, she saw, at 7 years old, she saw a play that was based on the voyage of Christopher Columbus to America. And she was so inspired by the thought of missionary work, even at that young age, that she developed this lifelong goal or yearning that was never going to be satisfied because she was a girl, first of all, and then wound up being a cloistered nun. But she, like, couldn't quite stifle that deep desire in her heart. And indeed, like, in the times, it was very important for, in the Catholic Church, to convert as many people as possible so that they would be, quote-unquote, saved. So she had this religious fervor. I believe she hit a universal core of spirituality, but she was a Catholic, and so it was important for them to think about converting those who didn't have the Catholic faith. So all these new souls in America, and she was 18 years old and just newly veiled as a nun and learning more of a contemplative life than she had ever had before, praying in her cell, then again had some of these deep visionary experiences. When she came out of them, she told her confessor, "I feel as though I've been in a different place, a place far away, a place with these Native Americans, and that I was teaching them about our God and Christ." And the confessor, of course, listened, you know, for several times through this. This went on for 3 years, and he ultimately, when he was seeking counsel about this, he told some of the other people in his order, and one of her confessors wound up writing to, because she named specific places. She named the Humanos and areas around Quivira, which would be in today's Palo Duro Canyon area in Texas, Amarillo area, and so the confessor named these places, wrote to the archbishop in Mexico, who was over the New Mexico area for the missions, and saying, here's, you know, have you heard anything that sounds like this whatsoever? And the archbishop received the letter and made an inquiry up to the mission in Isleta, not too far from Albuquerque, just a little south of Albuquerque here, where the headquarters were for the missions then in the early 1600s. So the caravan takes months to get from Mexico City up to Isleta, and at the time that it arrived, Humano Indians were there from every year they'd make their annual trade routes. They were very well regarded traders, nomadic traders, and hunters. And so every year, for about 6 years, they had come to the Isleta Pueblo and asked for baptism and for a mission in their area. And what happened in 1629 was that finally someone listened, because they had just gotten this letter from their archbishop in Mexico City, which had been spurred by a letter from Spain. And so Alonso Benavides is sitting in the Isleta mission, and the Humanos come in and ask again for baptism and a mission. And finally this time they say, well, why have you come? And they said, well, ladies, been here preaching to us, dressed in blue, and they pulled a picture off the shelf of another Conceptionist nun who was attired exactly the same as Sor Maria, and said, is this the woman? And that woman also had some mystical heritage, I would say. And they said, no, Our Lady is younger and much more beautiful. And so they kept up the dialogue there, and in the end, the missionaries followed them to their encampment. And again, they went back in 1632 to a different area in Texas. So it was a convergence of that inquiry that came from Spain and the Humano Indians coming to ask for baptism at the mission. And, of course, there's speculation about how could this be. Of course, that's going to happen because we weren't there and we can't see it. And we don't know necessarily the motivations of everyone involved in it, but that's
so. Here we are in the 21st century. You're writing a book about Maria Vágreda, and you hear this story. To you, the biographer of this person, is this a phenomenon that makes sense, or is it a coincidence? I mean, do you think that Maria of Ágreda mystically transported to Texas and converted the Indians?
I have to tell you, that was something I battled with for a few years. And I don't take the question lightly either, because it is quite confronting. And I don't know anyone who's experienced anything like that. And yet, whenever I came to that point, as I was writing and as I was determining how am I going to portray this highly unusual story, and what do I think? And in fact, my early readers would put down some of the material and say, Marilyn, what do you really think? And I went back to her writing. I went back to her testimony. And for years, she was explaining this to the Inquisition, to her confessors, you know, in writing and verbally and so forth. And so there is more information coming out, like about her testimony of what happened. I read through her responses to the Inquisition, which were very detailed questions about her experiences, and then also a kind of a seminal letter that she wrote to a Franciscan minister general. And in the end, she said, I guarantee that this case did, in fact, happen. But whether I went there physically, I'm really not sure. I feel that it was more spiritual, and we talked about that in the beginning of our conversation here. And so, okay, I'm back to square one here, and I thought, well, okay, my job is to figure out, for as me as a writer, some perspective on this. I want to portray the historical documentation as accurately as possible, but I really wanted to know for myself, and I just decided that I trusted her at some point. I had immersed myself so much in all of her writing and examined it upside and downside, and I thought, how could this be? But I decided to portray the story from her point of view and give her the benefit of the doubt. And I think that there are some unusual things that are possible. And here we are. Come on, Mary Charlotte. We're in the land of enchantment.
And unfortunately, it's time to go, and we have so much more talk to talk about here about Maria Vágreda.
Yes, indeed.
But you'll just have to go to Garcia Street Books tonight at 5 o'clock right here in Santa Fe. Marilyn Fidewa, thanks so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I've enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Nick Apolucci for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and then the Jazz Experience. Hasta la vista. Ciao.